Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. And guess what day it is today, and guess what's going to happen real soon. It's Wednesday, 3 days before our almost one day before our conference goes into full swing. On Friday, we are holding our third Empathic Therapies Conference in Syracuse, New York. And we do still have room for you to sign up. It's going to be a good, vital conference. We've got marvelous speakers. We've got a beautiful environment. And I just urge all of you to decide, I'm going. You can do it. You can still get here. You can still make it here by Thursday night to the hotel if you're coming in from out of town. And start at 8:30 in the morning on Friday, and then Saturday, and then half day Sunday. This year, we're going to have more opportunity to talk with people individually. We're doing fewer of the small workshops, more of the plenary presentations, and giving our presenters more time. For example, I was just on the phone today with Stephen Scheller. He is as big and important and effective an attorney and going up against drug companies as anybody in the world. He's coming in from Philadelphia. It's amazing that he comes to our conference. He's come once before. I feel very close to him. I think if I were a lawyer instead of a psychiatrist, I'd be doing a lot of what Steve Scheller does. He's going to present on Saturday morning for 2 hours about the latest in what's going on, Risperdal causing little boys to develop breasts, become obese, Risperdal causing tardive dyskinesia, and so on, with all the newer, supposedly safe antipsychotic drugs. Another attorney, Carl Protil, who's just a lovely man, is going to talk about malpractice suits, particularly in regard to the suicides of children. I've been involved in some of his suits. I've worked with Steve Scheller as well. We're going to have terrific presenters on how to help children find their greatness, the nurtured heart approach. It's going to be a conference that comes at this whole huge issue of mental health from two directions, critiquing psychiatry, biological psychiatry, and standing up for all the approaches that empower adults and children, the approaches that encourage independence and freedom and choice-making and health. A friend of mine recently wrote that psychiatry should make no claims to mental health or being a part of the mental health profession because it has nothing to do with mental health. Psychiatrists aren't trained in mental health. They don't have a concept of mental health. These are my colleagues. I can tell you for sure. They don't have any idea about empowerment or self-actualization or becoming independent. They haven't read Alfred Adler or Carl Jung. They've read drug company propaganda their whole careers. They don't know about being a happier, healthier, more creative, loving human being. We're facing that head on. And the difference between our organization and all others, and our conference and all others, is that we do both. We take responsibility not just for promoting the things that are good, but facing psychiatry for the harm it does. And that's been the whole problem with humanistic psychology. It's been the problem with other reform organizations. It's a problem with what used to be called the third force in psychiatry. It's from Carl Rogers to Maslow and all the great names of the past. None of them decided to do what we're doing, which is to say you can't just come up with your own therapy and say, here's my therapy, this is great. First of all, you've got to build a coalition they knew more about that. The humanistic psychologists and so on, they had a sense, maybe, a little bit of that. But also that we've got to let folks know that the other alternative is doing more harm than good, the psychiatric diagnoses and drugs. So that's what we're about. We're unique. We're the first to really do that. You can still get to the conference. You can still get on a bus or a car, get in a car, certainly a plane, fly to Syracuse, drive to Syracuse. And we won't have another conference in Syracuse next year. So we're going to be looking around for other alternatives around the country. So this is a chance to see the original series, the third in the series here in Syracuse, New York. And remember what I've asked you to do to make me happy? Come on up to me at the conference and say, I heard you on the radio and I came. Let me know I'm touching somebody with my radio show. Let me know. It'll be a good thing for all of us. Now, my guest today, wish I'd been in contact with her earlier. Her name is Jeannie Stolzer, S-T-O-L-Z-E-R, S-T-O-L-Z-E-R, Jeannie Stolzer. Ginger and I met Jeannie many years ago at a meeting of my old organization. We just met briefly. Jeannie stayed aware of my work. She is a professor of child and adolescent development. She's at the University of Nebraska in Kearney. K-E-A-R-N-E-Y, University of Nebraska in Kearney. She's got a whole bunch of really interesting peer-reviewed publications on boyhood and on what she calls the meteoric rise of psychiatric medications prescribed to children and adolescents. She's a really passionate child advocate. That makes her one of us for sure. And she is a courageous, strong woman who also wants to see courageous, strong men and boys, which I love. And so I'm just really, really happy to welcome Jeannie Stolzer to the show. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Bregan. So glad to be here with you.
Oh, I'm really happy about this. Where would you like to begin? Do you want to tell us something about yourself or about this medicalization of boyhood that you and I believe is occurring?
Yeah, I think this all started for me many, many years ago in the early 80s. I was teaching kindergarten at a private school, and none of my kids had any psychiatric diagnoses. And as time passed, I watched, alarmingly enough, that these kids were getting labeled with all these different psychiatric illnesses, and I thought, this is very different than when I was involved in early childhood education. And that's what basically got me started. I went on to get a PhD and to do a lot of research in this area, and in my opinion, we're witnessing the greatest hoax ever perpetuated on the American public. That's how I view it. When I look at the DSM and the criterion for ADHD, fidgeting, running, jumping, climbing, this is childhood, and they've medicalized it and made it a disease, particularly with young males.
I want to really emphasize this for the audience. You're working in the schools in the 1980s?
Yes.
And what's your role in the schools in the 1980s?
I was a teacher at a private school.
So let's say you have how many children? People need to hear this because, you know, a lot of folks weren't around in the 80s, and they don't really get what's happened. So how many kids do you have in your class at that point?
Oh, between 13 and 20. It varied. And I also was an after-school care provider, too, and I knew all the students and the parents. So I'd been involved in this for about 13 years in early childhood education. And
Let's say, Jeannie, you're going to see 50 kids in a day one way or another, maybe, or 40 kids. How many of them in the 1980s had a psychiatric diagnosis?
Zero.
Do you hear that, folks? The world went on with zero psychiatric diagnosis and drugging of children.
Now, let me make it clear. Did we have children who were running, jumping, fidgeting, climbing? Of course we did. So we had more recesses. and we had more physical activity, more tactile experiences. We didn't look at this as a disease that needed psychiatric drugs. We looked at it as boyhood. And was it hard for us as teachers and administrators to deal with it? It is. I mean, childhood, it's bouncing off the walls. Adults, we're so old and tired, we can't bounce off the walls with them, so it makes us frustrated.
Well, I think that's a really, 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 really important point. Now, and I'm sure you know some of those kids undoubtedly were troubled. Some of those kids were undoubtedly having difficult times at school or at home. But I think in those days, teachers paid more attention to the real child and what the child was struggling with. Is that your impression, that teachers reached out more before they could drug their kids or recommend them for drugs?
Absolutely. And then what we did was get to the root of the problem. So if there was a problem at home, you know, if dad was an alcoholic or mom was abusive or whatever the problem was, then we dealt with that. But now we've got into this medical model where we don't even touch that. We don't even touch the familial sphere. What we do is take the child out of that type of environment, call them disordered, and then we label them officially and drug them. It makes absolutely no sense. We have to get to the root of why this is occurring.
Now, when you were back in the private school setting, would you actually address serious issues with parents? That's a little hard to imagine. Did you have the opportunity to do that?
In one or two cases, but I don't think it was very common. I was an oddball teacher. We were always outside in the mud and, you know, running amok here and there, learning our ABCs in the mud and in the sand. So it was just a whole different type of learning environment. That's how I believe children learn, and that's what we did.
What age groups?
5 and 6.
I don't imagine you had 18-year-olds in the sandbox.
No, these are 5 and 6-year-olds, kindergartners.
Well, nowadays, a fair number of those would be diagnosed and drugged. You know, the latest data now is that one-fifth of our high school boys, just about 20%, one-fifth of them are diagnosed ADHD at some point in their life. I suspect it's even higher than that. So we've gone from zero, of course, zero when I was growing up. I mean, back in the 50s, graduated high school in 54. I mean, there was nothing like this at all. But, you know, the families were much more intact. Divorce was rare, very, very rare. Children, I believe, were actually treasured and valued more then than now.
I absolutely agree with you.
Women saw their kids more as their job. They didn't feel guilty or embarrassed about being parents.
And attachment. Attachment was solidified, you know, by 4 or 5 years of age because, like you just said, you were with your mother, and she was your secure base, and that's not happening anymore. We're dismantling that, and for some reason, we've convinced women that their most important thing that they can do in their lives is be a dentist or an orthodontist or a lawyer as opposed to being a mother, and I think we went off the tracks there.
Let's talk about that. I haven't really addressed that on this show. Ginger and I talk about this a lot. And, tell me about your own thinking. I mean, you're a very strong woman. You're full of life. You've taken responsibilities. You're a professor. And you're a tenured professor. How did you come through the era of feminism? Where do you stand now? How do you view this whole issue of mothers and their children versus all the other demands, opportunities, and ideals?
Well, I always knew intrinsically that the most important role that I would ever play on this planet was mother. I knew that just somewhere deep. You know, it was sort of a primordial knowledge that I had. And that has never wavered with me. I think that many, many people in this culture believe that they get, you know, self-satisfaction from going to work. I think right now 78% of all American mothers of children 3 years of age and younger are reporting that they work for self-fulfillment. And for me, as a developmentalist, that's really disheartening. You're not getting any self-fulfillment from raising your child. How did we get here? We're the only mammal on this planet that on purpose leaves our young. we can't wait to get away from them. And so there's been some real changes occurring, some real changes, and we have to address them. And I realize this isn't popular to talk about this. I know I'm offending so many people, but I think we have to look at it. What's happened to attachment? We're mammals.
God, it makes me think about cowbirds going and laying their eggs in other birds' nests.
That's right, yeah.
Oh, that's a terrible image, and I apologize to anybody I've offended, but it's a real issue, and it's difficult to confront. Attachment. And what happens, of course, is that our children now are getting attached to caretakers.
Well, I couldn't agree more. They're not getting attached to anyone, because the average American child in a daycare in America has 4 to 5 full-time caregivers in their first year. So if Bowlby's right with his attachment theory, it takes time for attachment to occur and trust. And our children aren't getting that. They're not getting it at all. And what are we going to do with the whole generation that never grew up with a secure base?
Well, thanks for correcting me on that, because you're right. That is not attachment. Our kids are not getting that opportunity in their early years. And I think that's a part of why we're seeing this so-called increase in the diagnosis of autism, and now we're going to have autistic spectrum disorders, and we're going to have all these ads about how many kids are like this, and as if suddenly a gene mutated and we've got all these new biochemical disorders, when A, most of it is just promotional. But the part that's real is that more and more of our kids are growing up detached and growing up without a sense of real connectivity and real connection to other people, because it starts immediately. Tell me more of your thoughts. You know a lot about this, and I should be quiet, except I'm so excited about talking to you.
And I'm so excited about talking to you.
Well, unravel some more of this for us about the importance of these early years and what research shows, what you've learned.
Well, we know the early years are critical, but I don't know if it's happening to you in New York, but it's certainly happening to me in Nebraska. We're bombarded with all of these public service announcements on the television and the radio about how critical the first 4 or 5 years are. So we have to get them in quality daycare so they can learn their ABCs. And a developmentalist like myself is just tearing their hair out when they're hearing this. What early infancy and early childhood has always been across every culture, across every time frame, and across every mammalian species, infancy and early childhood is about solidifying attachment between mother and child. That's what it's for. And then, when that attachment is solidified, then you go out and start doing cognitive things, learn la la la, and doing this and building that. But until then, you're with your mother. And we forgot this. We forgot the ancient wisdom of our ancestors who knew this. And no, they didn't know Bowlby's theory or, you know, how Adler talked about. They didn't know this. But they knew the importance of that early attachment, that it was critical to adult formation.
Yeah, I think of the Native Americans where the women would go out and gather, in many of the tribes, with the babies on their backs or in their arms.
That's right. Long-term resting, co-sleeping, being with your mom, that was the foundation. And we're losing it all. We're stripping. We're pretending like we're not even mammals. I mean, breastfeeding rates are plummeting, co-sleeping rates. It's unbelievable. And look how much we're turning over to the schools, you know, to do for us. Schools were set up for, you know, to teach reading and writing and arithmetic, as we used to say in the old days. And now they become, you know, unpaid brokers for the pharmaceutical industry. It's the craziest thing. And I really think, maybe I'm wrong about this, you tell me your opinion on this. Do you think that average American realizes that these psychiatric illnesses, ADHD, Asperger's, bipolar, do you think the average American knows that these are voted into existence by the American Psychiatric Association? And then they're voted out. For example, homosexuality was a confirmed psychiatric illness until they voted it out in 1978, and now it's not. So diseases that are voted in and out of existence, I mean, this is ludicrous. It's crazy.
Well, We've got some new ones being, I forget the new tongue twister about the emotional dysfunctional disorder of some kind that's been voted in for children now.
Huh?
That is going to, do you remember the name of it?
No, it's too long, but they'll have an acronym for it here soon.
But we're going to just have more and more of our kids being diagnosed with looser and looser criteria that are very serving to the drug companies. Now, you put in a word there. You mentioned co-sleeping along with the breastfeeding, nursing. So tell us more about your ideas about the closeness that should exist in a family.
Well, again, across all mammals, across all cultures, and across all time, right now, 2013 data sets are showing that about 75 to 80% of all cultures are practicing breastfeeding and co-sleeping in tandem. And of course we co-sleep and breastfeed our young. We're mammals, and the root cause of it is protection. You don't put a baby, you know, a baby lion or, you know, a baby hyena over there on the savanna and then go sleep away from them. That's ridiculous. You have to nurse them through the night, and you have to protect them through the night. We're told in this country, nope, put them upstairs, you know, with the baby monitor, and that's what we're doing. And it's disrupting attachment processes. Plain and simple, it is.
Now, how old do you think co-sleeping should go on?
Well, when we look at data sets from around the world, it's really up to the child. It's child-led, and it varies so much because some have older siblings they want to sleep with, so they may be getting out of the family bed very quickly. Others that are only children, maybe a little bit longer. Depends on a lot of variables like personality type and family constellation. All of those things matter. But it's really child-led. When the child feels ready, they go. And what it's clearly showing is that the child does fabulous in their own room by themselves. It's the parents that are waking up and saying, is he okay? And going in and checking. So that's interesting data.
That is very interesting data. You know, it reminds me of what's going on in my family right now. Of course, we're long past the children now and into the grandchildren. But we always have two Shetland sheepdogs for our family. And we got a new one. I call her Stickerdoodle. She's a kind of a very small Sheltie. When she was about 9 months old, and we've had her for about 6 months, and she came from a pack into our family with another older dog, and right away she got things organized. And you know, the Shelties, they really do herd you.
This one's the herding dog.
Yeah, this is the biggest herder I've ever seen. And the first thing that she learned to do was to herd us all into the bedroom before bed to play on the bed, our bed, and to keep us company and to get petted. And now, and we weren't doing this with the older dog, now we've got a step stool so she can jump up, and then the older dog comes up, and the Galen, and then everybody hangs out together, and then I get in the bed, or Ginger gets in the bed, and as we're getting ready to fall asleep, we take the dogs off the bed, but they stay in the room with us. And it's so clear how much these mammals, I just love how you're putting it, how much these mammals are reminding us about co-sleeping.
That's exactly right. And you said a key word. They're a pack. They are. They need others. They're social mammals. And you know what's interesting to me thinking about co-sleeping and breastfeeding is that no one on the planet sees a mother lion nursing her young and co-sleeping with him and looks at that and says, you know, that lion's going to grow up to be this dependent, clingy lion. No one thinks that. They know this is a little tiny baby lion, and he needs to be nursed, and he needs to sleep with his mommy. And, yeah, he will grow in time with maturational processes into this great, strong, courageous, ferocious lion. But at that time, when he's a little tiny lion, he needs his mother.
Well, I'm going to be blunt. As a woman, you're not afraid of boys growing up to be strong, courageous lions?
Absolutely not. As a matter of fact, check McKenna's research on this. We know this because he's been doing data collection on this for over 40 years. Co-sleeping breastfed children actually have a stronger sense of self. They're more independent than those who crib slept. They are. And as a parent, I could tell you that sounds like a glorious thing, but boy, as they hit adolescence and early adulthood, you go, my God, you know, what did I do? because they are very independent, and they know their own minds. And that's what the data is clearly showing. It doesn't make a clingy, dependent individual. It does make this strong sense of self, and this I know what I want and what I'm going to do.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, if you want to make a clingy, dependent human being, you just don't give them enough as a child.
That's exactly what you do. You
simple
want
formula.
Dependent, never, you know, afraid to do anything and spread their wings. Make them afraid from birth that none of their needs will be met. That's how we do it. Mm-hmm. Just strip them of all trust. Do it. You can do that with any mammal.
That's a good observation. Yeah, I'm sure there's research. Well, we know the research on monkeys, and we know in the wild what happens to monkeys who lose their attachment through a death early on. And, you know, they become horribly depressed, and they can even die, and maybe they can be rescued sometimes by a big brother who takes over being their attachment. But it's all laid out there with animals, but we're in complete denial about human beings.
Absolutely, and we really have forgotten that we're mammals. It's not even in our vernacular anymore.
Well, I like this a lot because, you know, I'm much more used to talking about human beings and the human spirit. I don't emphasize very much that we're mammals. I love this emphasis. Jeannie Stalter, you're inspiring to talk to.
Thank you.
I really, time is zipping by here. We've got about, you know, a few minutes before we'll go to a break. Wow. What kind of hardships do you run into talking about this stuff?
Well, I think I've managed over the last 12 or 13 years to sort of make everyone mad. And that's from the pharmaceutical companies to the medical institutions to the schools, because I'm questioning everything. I want to know how we went from no psychiatric drugging of our children, none, to some estimates, 12 to 14 million kids. And yes, I do realize that our schools are profiting economically for each child labeled. I really wonder how many of your listeners know that, too, that each time a school gets a child formally diagnosed from a physician, that individual school receives money for that. Most parents are not aware of that. And most parents aren't aware that 98% of all referrals for psychiatric diagnoses come directly from the United States public school system.
Wow. Now, this is so, so, so incredibly important. I mean, we're raising our kids to fit into these bureaucratic, boring, routine school activities, drugging them if they deviate or rebel or get bored or stare out the window or get angry. And we're doing everything but empower young boys and young girls, young folks, to feel their own strength, to feel independent, to feel that they have something to contribute. Because when people are strong and independent and well-attached, they don't stay home by themselves. They go out and contribute to the community. They do things that are valuable and useful.
Yes, and we're forgetting this, too. Adolescence, part of adolescence, is taking risks and doing things that parents find, you know, oh, my God, I can't believe this is happening. That's part of it. It doesn't mean you're sick. It means you're taking risks, finding out who you are, finding out about autonomy. This doesn't mean you're sick. It means you're an adolescent. And does it drive parents crazy? Yes. And how many of those parents out there know that these psychiatric drugs that they're putting their children on willingly are in the same classification of drugs with heroin and methamphetamine and morphine and cocaine? Most people don't know that these are highly addictive, dangerous medications that their children are taking with their cornflakes. I can't believe I've lived to see this. That's really where I'm at right now.
Jeannie Stalter, S-T-O-L-Z-E-R. She's professor of child and adolescent development at the University of Nebraska-Kearney. We're going to go to a break very shortly. I expected my wonderful engineer, Giselle, to start playing music soon. How can people get in touch with you?
They can email me at Stolzer, J-M, at UNK.com. www.cyhealth.edu, or they can call me at 308-865-8234.
Okay, don't panic, folks. We'll repeat that when we come back, and to break we go. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin, and it's the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour. My guest, Jeannie, J-E-A-N-N-E. Did I get that right? Jeannie Stoltzer.
You got it.
I'm the world's worst speller. Thank God for spell check. Jeannie, give your email again, would you? Because that took a little time.
It's Stolzer, S-T-O-L-Z-E-R, J-M, at U-N-K dot E-D-U.
And that's unk.edu.
Yes.
Jeannie, I have visiting with me today two friends who are Adlerianly oriented psychologists, two dear friends. And I took a little break to ask them what they thought of the show. And they're having trouble with the concept of the co-sleeping.
Of course they are. And let me guess. Are they American?
They're American.
Yes, we do. We have serious trouble. We are an outlier in this. I told you earlier that about 80% of the world right now is practicing co-sleeping. So if you go anywhere in Asia, anywhere in Africa, this is what they're practicing. We were practicing it, too, until about 200 years ago. And then we introduced the crib. And we really did believe the underlying theory or impetus for that crib was that that would create quicker independence. Now, you got to explain to me how being scared out of your mind in a dark room by yourself in a thing, you know, with bars on it creates earlier independence. Because Bowlby is rolling over in his grave saying, no, 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 how we create independent people is in early childhood. We meet their security needs, and then they fly. So many, I'm very used to this. Many.
Well, I want to have a really good talk about it because I think it's very interesting. Some of the, and let me say that this is an unusual experience for me because, you know, I have, as folks know, by the time I've reached this age, I've got pretty clear ideas about a lot of things in life. And I'm unsure about this, which makes it particularly interesting, this difference of opinion.
Oh, and I think you just said a very important word, opinion. But what does the research say? Again, look at McKenna's work. J.J. McKenna is the leading researcher in the world in this area. He's devoted the last 40 years to it. So our opinions do matter, but I'm more into the research facts. And what is the research? What's the data saying? So that's my inclination.
One of the issues, the couple of the issues, and you've heard them before, I'm sure, that my two friends who are clinical psychologists raised, and parents, were, you know, what about boundaries, and what about, you know, learning your separation?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not being very articulate about it, and just, you know, the kinds of issues that come out of being very dependent, or at least in this case, you're saying having a dependence needs met. Let's talk about some more. And also, can you describe in a little bit more detail some of the research, and also, it's also on my mind, in your experience or the research, when it's a matter of children's choice, that's such a wonderful concept in general, when it's a matter of children's choice, what sort of range does one find? And how does this work into the marital bed and lovemaking and all that stuff? So
I knew that's what you were trying to get at because that.
No, actually, I couldn't remember what I was trying to get at.
But the American ethos sort of goes to this place. Oh, my God, what about marital relations? It's a very good question. So we got to look at this 80% of the world that is practicing co-sleeping. So they're not having marital relations? Of course they are. It's just not in the family bed. I'm not a sex researcher, but according to the sex research, those couples who have to get creative in their sex life, because they can't have sex in the family bed, the child is there, the children are there, they have to become much more creative in their sexual endeavors. So the sex research is very clear. The more positions and the more locations, the happier the sex life. So my opinion on this is that those in Africa and most of Asia are having a much more happy sex lives than Americans. So I think that's very important.
A little infant can sleep through almost anything if we're talking about little infants, I suppose. But now, what happens in America, do we know, or England or Germany, if the parents practice child choice? What kind of variation do you see in how long children sleep in the family bed?
Well, what I can say with scientific accuracy is it varies a lot. Italy is a lot longer than England. England is starting to look much more like the United States in terms of co-sleeping and breastfeeding. But then you look at places like Japan, who happen to be the longest co-sleepers in the industrialized world. They're co-sleeping for 6 or 8 years.
Wow.
So it just varies.
And you feel that's fine?
It varies all over the world. I think we have to look to the data. And when we look at these Japanese children, adolescents, adults, they seem to be doing a lot better than Americans. As far as
when they get here, they outcompete us in school for sure.
And psychosexual health. I'm sorry, psychosocial health. That was a Freudian slip. Did you hear it?
Oh yeah, but it is all the same. I mean.
Yep. So I think we just have to sort of take off our American blinders with regard to this issue. That really, across all mammals, they don't worry about their children not, you know, becoming independent. They know the lion's going to be independent, but right now he's sleeping with me in nursing. Soon, he'll be an adolescent and off doing his crazy things, and then he'll be an adult. But right now, in this little, tiny, teeny piece of lifespan development, he's with me.
Now, give us something to work on in terms of what you're seeing, other than wide variation, what you're seeing in America when families begin to practice this. Can you talk about the variation you're seeing? I mean, if you have three kids, are two of them going to be in the bed or three of them in the bed? Can you talk a little bit about the experience of what you see with parents who begin to practice this, or is that not something you have at your fingertips?
Well, yeah, I'm published in this area, but like you just talked about, there is so much variation, and we have what we call closet co-sleepers in America. They don't want to tell anybody because they're American, and worse than that, we have immigrants coming to this country that's all they've ever known. So a Japanese mother and father come to this country, they're starting to practice co-sleeping, and the American friends say, what? The child is sleeping in your room? You can't. So they, too, are discontinuing breastfeeding and co-sleeping because they want to acclimate. They want to be accepted. So that's what the data is showing right now, that when they get on these shores, they stop this. But when you really look at the data around Americans, it's pretty frightening. For example, 80% of all the world's serial killers were born and raised in America. Something's wrong. 80% of all psychiatric drugs are given to Americans? What's wrong with us? What are we doing? And how can it be fixed?
I can easily see how insomnia could relate to this kind of an issue, because certainly one of the big tribulations in America is getting kids to go to sleep when they're little, and how long do you let them cry, and so on and so forth. And that probably disappears with co-sleeping, or nearly.
I love that you brought that up, because it doesn't even exist, all these sleep problems that we know of in this country. There's a ghost under my bed, I'm hungry, I'm tired, I'm scared, blah, 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 blah. Doesn't even exist. Bedtime is a time that's nurturing and cuddly. There is no being afraid of the dark or being afraid to go to bed. It's a nurturing time. It's not scary. So we've done a huge disservice. But before I forget, can I say something? I want to talk about this. Just happened to me at a meeting this afternoon. We were looking at data from all around the United States, and we're watching a significant decline in males entering our universities. This is just American data. And I'm sorry to say this, and you may never have me as a guest again, but some of the more feministically oriented professors were hopping up and down so happy. And to me, this is a travesty. Where are these young males? And I asked them that. And they looked at me like I was crazy, like we're celebrating the females. And I said, no, I want to know where the young males are, because I know where they are. They've been labeled and drugged since they were 5 or 6 years old. They've been told they were learning disabled, psychiatrically disabled, ADHD, blah, blah, blah. So when it comes time to go to university, nope, I can't do this. So they're not there. And we're celebrating this. So I just had to get that off my chest because it's been eating at me since this meeting at 1 o'clock.
Yeah. I mean, that is so interesting. And, you know, the universities are so embedded in that kind of thinking, embedded, there's a Freudian slip too, so embedded in that kind of sleeping. I'm going to take a rest here. You really got me thinking. I rarely go into babbling on my radio show, and it's because you are raising a lot of issues that I haven't thought through, and that's unusual for me in this field that we talk about. I haven't thought this through, and it's been a long time since I've raised my own kids. I think it's extremely interesting. I'd just like you to talk some more. I think this is very enlightening. Is there any particular piece of research that you find especially enlightening? You mentioned this I've never heard of. I usually know about research. I don't know about this research. You mentioned McKenzie or McKenna or somebody.
It's capital M-C, capital K-E-N-N-A. And I've also published in this area. And I never thought I would get to the point in my career that I'd publish so many papers I can't remember the names of some of them, but that's what just happened to me. I'm trying to think.
Well, just tell us some more about what your own data shows, your own experience. Are you seeing any problems? Are you seeing any problems coming out of six-year-olds still sleeping in bed with their parents?
Absolutely none. Absolutely none. And I think, again, as Americans, we sort of wear these blinders because, you know, our way is the right way, and it has to be. But when you take those blinders off and you look around the world, we really are the outliers. We really are. We're the ones who are feeding artificial formula in a crib with a baby monitor to our young mammals. We're the outliers. We're not doing something right. All you have to do is look at the stats around the world, whether you're looking at mass murder or psychiatric drugging or divorce rates or any of them. We're at the top.
Well, you got to be careful, and you know this as well as I, of taking one variable like co-sleeping.
Oh, no, I always put it with breastfeeding. To me, they're...
And even two variables, you know, there's so much that goes on in America right now. I'm a little reluctant to make too strong an epidemiological connection, but it's certainly worth thinking about. And I wanted to pick up on that theme again, Jeannie. You're connecting the co-sleeping with nursing very closely. And how long are some of the folks who are in the U.S. in particular, I'm interested in because of the this culture, how long are some of the kids nursing? Are they nursing till they're six?
Again, we're supreme outliers here. The average weaning rate in the world today is 3.2 years.
Is it really?
Yes, it is.
I didn't know that. Yeah?
It is. We come in at 6 weeks because of our federal policies that won't give any paid maternity leave. We're the only country on the planet who doesn't give its women paid maternity leave so they can breastfeed long term. So if you take us out of that data set at the 6 weeks, it'll go up. So, yeah, average weaning rate in the world today is 3.2 years.
And for us, it is that 6 weeks based on the government rules about leave, maternal leave.
Yep, and plus the mass sexualization of the female breast. In America, we have so sexualized the female breast, it can no longer even be viewed as a mammalian, a nurturing part of motherhood. You know, it's to put silicone in and put up in bras and push them up. And, you know, that we're comfortable with. But seeing a nursing baby in Walmart, we go, oh God, you know, take that home. It's just amazing how we've changed, and again, how we're slipping further and further away from our bioevolutionary mammalian heritage.
Wow. I'm just going to be saying wow a lot. You know, I'm a great admirer of a lot in Adlerian psychology, and so it's very interesting to me that Adlerian psychology has put a lot of emphasis on not connecting in that manner to young children. I gather that. In fact, my two friends are in the other room, and if they want to come in here and coach a little bit and ask some questions, you guys want to come in, Tim and Jerry, I'd be happy to come join me. They're watching this, listening to this on the, at least last I looked in, they were listening to me. Maybe not, because they're not trying.
Maybe
yet.
Not.
I think they've gone for a walk. Maybe it was too much for them.
It was too much for them. They left the building.
Well, and this is going to be a lot for a lot of listeners. The idea of envisioning a six-year-old sleeping in bed with mom, nursing with mom.
No. Nursing, that would be an outlier. A six-year-old nursling would be an outlier. You know, we have to say that.
Okay, good.
So we got to go with the world norms. We don't want to make this sensationalized. A six-year-old nursing.
That would be 3 years or so.
Yeah, would be an outlier. Does it happen?
Yeah.
Yes. Is it common anywhere around the world? No.
Oh, wait, come on in, guys. What is your response? You can speak quietly or get on the mic.
Well, I would definitely say that it's more of our view that we...
Actually, why don't you... This is...
Hi, Jeannie. We're listening with interest, of course, to your program. And one of the things that we do as parent educators is we try and help parents to take their children and to have them to become, at the end result, responsible young people who can make their way in the world.
Absolutely.
So we talk a lot about the child's ability to self-soothe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's the other question I had, which was interesting, is just looking at the overall mental health. I mean, we know, like the Japanese, their mental health isn't as, it's maybe equivalent. It's not worse than Americans in terms of suicide, alcoholism, drug abuse.
It depends on where you live.
I guess the other thought I had was a lot of the countries that maybe everybody's sleeping in the same room, it's out of necessity because they're of poverty or social economic status. And then there was an interesting study I heard on NPR where it was in Africa. They were looking at parenting techniques. And in this one village or tribe, they actually carry the babies on the outside facing the world to help them be independent. And they were looking at the independence and the self-reliance of the children. And I thought that was very interesting because the commentator was talking about the 10-year-old. There was a 10-year-old boy, and they needed him to help them out on a trip, and he just left home and came back, and he was gone for 2 or 3 days, and the parents weren't overly concerned. So those were some of the thoughts we had while we were listening to what you were talking about.
Okay. Now, I want to talk about the issue of self-soothing. This is a relatively new concept in parenting. If you look across any culture, across any mammal, or across any time, there's a particular time frame in human developmental processes where you're not able to self-soothe. Now, can you cry yourself to sleep? We all know Ferber, and you will cry yourself to sleep, and you can call that self-soothing if you want to, but even Ferber has recounted and said, I was wrong. You know, this has serious socio-emotional implications, because what you're learning very early, and I think Erickson even spoke to this himself with the trust versus mistrust stage of human development, if you learn you can't trust your needs to be met, and that's one thing that's really important, too, is a baby's needs and her wants are the exact same thing. A 5-year-old, no. But their needs and their wants are the same thing. You know, skin-to-skin contact is not a want. It's a need. So I think that that's one thing that we've done is we bought into this self-soothing. And I think that this can be tied into our self-soothing behaviors as we grow. Self-soothing with martinis. Self-soothing with Prozac. That we are soothing ourselves. But why do we have to? There's other people there that we're supposed to be able to trust and to love. So I think we just come to this from very different. I come from it from a very bioevolutionary perspective, looking across all mammals and all time. And other people come to it from a much more behavioristic, reinforcement type theory. And I think both are legitimate and need to be talked about.
By the way, for my listeners, I just realized why Tim and Jerry took so long to get from the other room into here. There's a time delay on the radio show. So I'm waiting for them to come in, and they haven't even heard yet that I've asked them. So it wasn't that they disappeared. It was a time delay. Well, this is, again, this is extremely interesting to me, and it's going to, I think, be very interesting to a lot of our listeners, get us thinking more and more about this. I think my heart in many ways goes with you. Now, I got to get to science, too, obviously.
Yep, but I'm always important
start
here.
With my human experience, and what you're saying, you know, it does make a lot of sense. You think about how much parents torture themselves while their children cry in another room, and how much the children are experiencing abandonment and getting used to that, coping with that in the other room.
This is cultural.
I agree with you that it would be a kind of revolutionary change in the development of personality and character to be taken care of that way.
And we do have that. I'm sure you're familiar with Connor and Werthmann's seminal studies. He did. He looked exactly those questions that you're asking. He looked at tribal communities like the Kung, K-U-N-G, and he wanted to know these questions that you're asking me. When you're raised like this, how do you perform? How do you act as an adult? And he was absolutely mesmerized by what he saw when these primordial bioevolutionary needs were met, that we didn't have these anxiety-prone, scared out of their wits, drug-addicted human beings walking the planet. They had these self-assured people who had a secure base and were sure of themselves. And it's a whole different way to look at human development.
You know, I'm guessing that it would absolutely eradicate so-called autism.
Absolutely. Gone.
Is that the research experience?
It's not my research experience because I haven't got enough funding because, you know, the pharmaceutical industry.
No, I know. I mean in the literature. Has anybody looked at that?
Yeah, we don't see autism. We don't see it in places in tribal Africa. Interestingly enough, we don't see it with the Amish in the United States of America either. But there goes that multivariational analysis you were talking about. My God, the Amish do so many things different than we do. They long-term co-sleep, they long-term breastfeed, but they don't have electricity, they don't have cars, blah, blah, blah. They don't eat pesticides. So God knows what it is.
I'm learning every minute you speak. I mean, I didn't know that about the Amish.
And people think they don't go to the doctors, but that's absolutely incorrect. They do go to doctors. They don't have any taboos against doctors. They do go to doctors. So it's not that the doctors aren't seeing if the child's autistic. They're just not.
Wow. Tell me more about the reception. Are you getting any really positive response on some of these ideas?
Yes, and what I try to do, I absolutely try to do, is stay with the data, because if I go veering into my opinions or my thoughts, then is when I get in trouble. But if I can stay with the empirical facts, you know, you can not like facts or wish they didn't exist. But when a fact is a fact, and you can wish it wasn't, but it's a fact. So I try to stay with that, because when you look at other mammals, for example, we don't have any of these questions that we have with co-sleeping and breastfeeding. Of course, that's just what a mammal does. But with us, we say, oh, my God, will it make this clingy, dependent? And what about self-soothing? Of course, the baby llama is not self-soothing. It's a baby. So, very different.
Jeannie Stolzer again, S-T-O-L-Z-E-R. Jeannie, what did you get your PhD in?
My PhD is in human development. The emphasis is child and adolescent development. So my PhD is in child and adolescent development.
Is there enough people with your views that you can have a small conference in the United States? What does this look like?
Yes, Attachment Parenting International. And McKenna's going to speak there this year. I think that's in November. There's a body of literature out there, and they do have academic conferences, and they do have academic journals. Are they popular in the United States? No. We want our formula. We want to be back to work at 6 weeks old. We want that child at the daycare center. We want the Ritalin and the Adderall at age four. And don't question it. But I am questioning it.
Now, we have an attachment parenting movement in the U.S. that, for example, I had a wonderful professor on talking about attachment play as a way to handle all kinds of problems with children. But when we think of attachment theory or attachment theory in practice, what portion of those folks are talking about this on-demand co-sleeping and nursing?
Oh, that's the core. It's one of the cores. Yeah.
Interesting.
It's the nucleus.
Well, I've been missing a lot. I'm into a new area with you. It's really marvelous what you're bringing here. I wish I'd talked to you a little earlier, because the next time I hold a conference, I'm gonna invite you to come with bells on and talk about these issues.
I'm gonna hold you to that.
Oh God, I think it's incredibly important. I'm just learning to really think a lot more about these issues. Well, listen, I hear the music in the background.
Thank you, Dr. Bregan.
Oh, this is Peter Bregan. You've been listening to Jeannie Stoltzer. Thank you for a courageous career and for articulating so very well these very interesting and important concepts. Thanks very, very much.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.